are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, April 27th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont writer Castle Freeman, Jr. The author of four novels, a story collection, and a collection of essays, Castle Freeman, Jr. has been a regular essayist for the Old Farmer's Almanac since 1982. He's also a contributor to Vermont Life magazine. His writing has appeared in many literary and other magazines over the years, including New England Review, Southwest Review, Yankee, Harvard Magazine, and The Atlantic. He lives in Newfane, Vermont. I spoke to Castle earlier this month. I asked him to talk about his relationship with Vermont, how he came to live here and make a writing life.
Well, my wife and I were living in Philadelphia, where I had been a graduate student, and we had the opportunity to go where we wanted to go. I quit being a graduate student and worked down there for a couple of years, and I was working as a freelancer, so we could go anywhere. My wife comes from Williamstown, Mass., which is just south of Bennington, so she knew the general area, which I did not. I'm from the Midwest. But I had always wanted to live in a rural setting with forests and fields and such like, and so I was eager to give it a try, and we came up, me with a freelance job, and moved up to Putney, Vermont. This was in the summer of 1972, and we liked it immediately and have been here ever since.
Now, when you say freelance, was it journalism?
No, it was. I was working for a company in Philadelphia that published abstracts of biomedical articles in cancer research. It was more like technical writing, technical editing. I would read the articles and I would make abstracts of them, and they were published in a huge fat compendium that was distributed to cancer researchers by the National Institutes of Health.
Well, that
very different kind of thing from from real writing.
Well, I would think that the jump from that kind of writing to fiction is difficult.
Well, I guess it would have been, but I did that for three or four years, not all that long a time. And I had always been interested in writing in general, and fiction writing and essays and that sort of thing. So although I was making money by doing the technical writing, it wasn't really a preoccupation of mine, and it wasn't the only thing I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, somewhere I read that you wrote a lot of short stories.
I've written quite a lot of short stories. I'm mostly, I think, a short story writer, more than I am a novelist. I also have written many essays, journalism, op-ed, natural history type stuff, how-to type stuff, quite a range of things.
Oh. Your latest book, All That I Have, is narrated in the first person by a character named Sheriff Lucian Wing.
Mm-hmm.
Your previous book, Go With Me, was third person narration. Mm-hmm. You know, multiple characters would have their say. So I'm curious how you decide what narration you want to use in a book.
I don't know that I make a decision about it. It just sort of the way the book presents itself to my mind, I guess. I had in the case of All That I Have, I had wanted to write the story of a thief who steals what he doesn't understand and therefore puts himself in more jeopardy from the people he's stolen from than he is from the law.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is a cool story.
It is a cool story.
And is full of irony. So that was a story that I'd wanted long to write. But it's not a particularly original or unusual story. And it was not until I, one day, for reasons that I don't understand, happened on the idea of the first-person sheriff telling the story, I sort of began to hear him talking to me. And that kind of gave the whole story of the thief a new energy for me, mm-hmm. and a new level of interest. And it was at that point that I went ahead and wrote it from the sheriff's first person point of view, but I didn't decide in any deliberate or rational or logical way, gee, this would be a good way to tell the story. It just kind of came to me.
It just started to happen. Lucian Wing speaks like a more simple man than he finally turns out to be, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, he's a complicated guy.
His grammar's a little bit rough around the edges, and he has a habit of searching for the right word to express himself.
Yeah.
And he refers to himself as a highly uneducated lawman right here in the Valley. So I was curious what prompted you to create an uneducated lawman.
Well, I guess that's just how he came to me. One of the things that I liked about him was that he's a flawed figure in many ways, but he's a very smart guy in his own way, and yet he doesn't talk quite right. That's interesting to me.
Sure.
And you hear someone who says ain't got no this, and you perhaps you make a kind of a stereotype leap to his IQ, which is not high, but you're wrong. And this character demonstrates that.
Yeah.
That's part of his charm for me.
Right. And he has a certain amount of insight into himself.
Yes.
But he's not putting on an act at all. He is who he is.
No, he's not putting on an act, but he's not a paragon. He's got his flaws. He's a smart guy, but he's not perhaps always quite as smart as he thinks he is. He's a bit of a reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
He has a level of class envy, I think. He's not an attentive husband. He neglects his wife. So he's not perfect.
Will you write about him again, do you think?
I doubt that I would write about him as a main character. I suppose he might turn up in something else,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to get into a kind of a series situation.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't appeal to me.
No, your work almost seems more like it's profiling Vermont rather than a certain person or set of characters.
Yeah, I think I have written stories going back a number of years about a law enforcement figure who was similar in some ways to the sheriff in this book, in that he does his job with subtlety and a kind of a soft approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I've written about people like that before, but and I might again. I guess that must be a figure that interests me for some reason. But I don't want to get into a situation where I or anybody else expects me to crank out a new Sheriff Wing book every couple of years.
Right. I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read from your work.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, great.
So what we have, this is going to be the beginning of chapter 5, and the sheriff is reflecting on his life and how he got to be where he is. And he talks about his wife, whose name is Clemmy, and that's, I guess, about all the background that anybody needs.
This is Castle Freeman reading from All That I Have, which was published by Steerforth Press.
So this is chapter 5. The title of the chapter is It Is What It Is. How do people get to be where they are? I don't mean in any fancy way, but just that, where they are at. Location, location, location is what counts, they tell you, and they're right. Where have you passed through to get here? What's your geography? It looks as though you can work it either of two ways, straight line or winding. Some people, if they left tracks all through their lives and you could follow them, you'd find they wandered around like a deer in the snow. They see an ad in the paper and the next thing they know they're in California. They meet a fellow in a bar and they take off for Texas. They get in a card game and in another week they find themselves in New York City. If you asked them how they wound up there and not someplace else, they'd need a "What's a book of maps, a big book, to tell you. They'd need an atlas. With those people, getting to where they are has a lot of luck to it, it looks like. Luck, or call it chance. They're not me, those people. I'm the other way, straight line. It's like I was born at the station, got right aboard the train, and then went along on the rails. Started here, here I am, here I'll finish up. Clemmie's and my house today in Fayetteville Village is just four houses down from the house where I grew up. Four houses down and across the road. You don't get a much straighter line than that, do you? Though with me too, I guess, some part of geography was up to chance. I didn't have to go the road I did. I wasn't locked in. Every day there was another turn I could have taken. There were a thousand other turns, but I didn't. Others did, but not me. Am I sorry about that? Maybe a little, sometimes. Not much. This is my life, it looks like. This one here. One to a customer is the rule. It is what it is. Born at the station? Well, not quite, but near it. Our backyard went down to the old narrow gauge right-of-way. I could have walked out our kitchen door and flagged the train, except that the train quit running long before I was born. The trains were gone, the tracks were gone, the railroad had become a kind of fading path in the woods. But there was the old depot in the village. It held Arthur Tavistock's collection of dead tractors, but it had been the train depot. That was the station where I was, so to speak, born. I went to the old academy in Cardiff. I liked it. Stayed out of trouble, was a pretty good third baseman. Not much of a scholar, though I took the college prep course. And there's chance right there, too, because I wanted to take auto mechanics, but my mother wouldn't hear of it. School was school, she said. A garage was a garage. So I prepared for no college. But for that, I might be fixing cars in China today, rather than being a highly uneducated lawman right here in the valley. Got out of school and joined the Navy, the same as my father, though I lived to tell the tale and he didn't. One more in the long line of blue water men to come out of New England's only landlocked state. You see the world, the Navy tells you, and you do, in a manner of speaking. You see your ship, miles and miles and weeks of gray steel, and you see a whole world of places you never want to see again. Though it's true I didn't see a lot of shipping, I found what so many sailors before me have. I don't much care for ships. I did my tour in the shore patrol, the Navy's police force. So I was on dry land, first at Long Beach, then Da Nang. In the shore patrol, I found out that I have a talent for talking to people who are very, very drunk. And I learned that if talking don't work, you can do about anything you like with a drunk by grabbing tight hold of his nose and twisting. You won't do permanent damage, but he will come along. Plus, he'll put out quite a lot of blood, which changes the subject, makes him think, and impresses any friends of his who might want to join in the fun. Busting drunks and breaking up fights, that's what I did in the Navy. Got home in the spring of 69. I might have never been away except for no more school. What to do? Well, my Uncle Stuart was a logger. He could always use a new hand who, being family, he wouldn't have to pay very well. I joined his crew, and for a year I worked in the woods. But logging is more dangerous than anything I did or saw anybody else doing in Vietnam. A year of it was enough for me. I thought about going back to school, but what for? There was nothing I wanted to do that more school would make me better at. I drove truck for a donut distributor, but that ain't a real job. I quit. Was I restless? You could say I was restless. Then somebody told me the state police would like my having been shore patrol. I put in my application, and they did. They did like that. They took me on. So a year and change with the green and gold. I liked the work, but I can't say I ever liked the state police. No fault of theirs. They're a military organization, basically. They have to be. And I thought I'd had about enough of military organizations in the Navy. Plus, I was going out with Clemmie by then, and she plain refused to marry anybody who might be seen wearing one of those flat-brimmed cowboy hats the troopers have. Yes, I married above myself. Everybody says so. Clemmie says so, her old friends say so, her cousins say so, her father don't say so. You don't have to. Not that we were ever poor in our family. We were never poor, not close. My sisters and I could have anything we wanted. We had a deal with our mother. Her end was we could have anything we wanted. Our end was we wouldn't want too much.
Thank you very much.
I really do like the way he'll search for the right word.
Yeah.
And he did that in that section you just read where he looked for the word atlas.
Yeah. He does that two or three times.
Yeah, another couple times he says, the big lookers are the, what do you call the bad part or the good part? They're the downside. That's another example. Yeah. I enjoy that.
Well, that's meant to enforce the idea that this is really a pretty smart guy, because he searches for the word, but he always finds it.
He has
the vocab, and it's not really perhaps all that clear that he's really searching. That may just be kind of a riff that he's doing.
Yeah, maybe. On the other hand, it may just be that he's a perfectionist and he
needs
wants
the right
to
word.
Say the right thing.
Yeah.
I like that about him. I also, another thing about your books, and I've read two of them. I've read Go With Me, which was the book that came out before All That I Have.
Correct.
I really enjoy the deadpan delivery and sort of ironic repetition that's taking place sometimes. It's very funny. I'm wondering what your goal is or what you see the benefit of using humor to write your mysteries.
Oh, that's just my world view, I guess. I think humor is essential to life.
Right.
And I guess it's a kind of a natural perspective for me.
I think it comes off very well in helping the reader who might not know Vermont and Vermonters, because it's very Vermont, the way that you present the humor.
Yeah, of course there's Vermont humor is a whole library in itself, right?
Sure, yeah. But it doesn't come off as stereotyped Vermont, and it doesn't mock Vermont.
No,
so
right.
it's
well, I hope not. I seek always to avoid the expectable and the stereotype.
Right.
And yet, you need to be able to make use of all the stereotypes without exactly endorsing them.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that occurred to me while you were reading that excerpt, you talk about the train station that's no longer operational, and I thought that was interesting. You're sort of presenting Vermont as it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a big part of what you try to...
Since I've lived here, which is 35 or so years, the changes in the state have been a signal part of anybody's experience of living here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's true anywhere in the U.S., but it's particularly evident around here, I think, and that's definitely an important part of what I guess what appeals to me about the state as a subject matter for fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the people do anything or not, the change has happened. It's happening to them in their own lives, obviously because they're growing old, but history is passing and the state is not what it was. Even when we came, it seemed as though the people around where we lived had a clearer memory of the serious old agricultural life of the old times than they have now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just because they was the preceding generation.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, and I'm not sure if this is just because it's how he speaks or because you have a reason to do this as a writer, Sheriff Wing will address the reader directly. I'm going to just read a little excerpt, if you don't mind. The man in the patrol car was handcuffed behind his back. He had a blanket wrapped around his shoulders, the ends folded across his lap. He was short and skinny. He had long, greasy blonde hair and skin that was too white, as though he lived in your cellar or at the bottom of your well. When I read that, it kind of surprised me, which I liked. I wasn't expecting to be addressed in that way, your cellar, your well. Is that just how he spoke and you wrote it down, or is that something that you thought as a writer, this is valuable to his character that he does this?
I thought it was valuable. I think that it to sort of drop into the you second person there, it kind of, in an informal way, it adds emphasis and it adds intimacy with the reader,
mm-hmm.
seems to me. And it's also kind of colloquial, which is appropriate for the sheriff.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say, I suppose, well, you couldn't really say he looked like he lived at the bottom of one's well.
No.
I mean, that would be, that would be a bit much, I think. So you don't have to, get into stilted kind of constructions like that, and at the same time, by saying you get that kind of informality and connection with the reader, I guess is what I mean to say.
Absolutely, yeah. And it is more likely that someone would say at the bottom of a well, and then it would pass right by and no one would notice it.
Oh, yeah. If you just say at the bottom of a well, then you kind of lose some of the force of what you're saying, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
To say you, the reader doesn't quite expect that,
yeah,
as you said.
Right.
And so that perhaps he goes a little deeper into him or her that way.
It makes that person notice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Occasionally, Sheriff Wing will use stories within the larger story, which these stories help to paint a picture of the characters who live in the area, as well as filling in details that will be relevant to this plot. I'm thinking specifically in All That I Have about the story of Mort, whose wife slept with the oil burner repairman.
Right, right.
And the moral of the digression was blowing everybody up, don't always come out right. And then that statement gets us back to our storyline. Can you talk a little bit about this aspect of your narratives, telling little stories within the big story?
Yeah, I think that's very important to me to do that, and mainly because it's fun to make up the little stories. But also, I think what I try to do in this book and also in Go With Me is to give the reader a very vivid and memorable, if I'm successful, account of what it's like to live in a little community like this. And when the reader has finished the book, the reader has got, knows what happened, has got the story, knows the people, but knows more than that. The reader also has had the experience of life in this place in a particular time. And it's the little stories, really, that produce that effect,
mm-hmm,
more than the plot or the characters that are the vehicle for
mm-hmm
them. So yeah, the little subsidiary stories, little digressions and stuff like that are very, very important to the overall purpose of the book, as far as I'm concerned.
Do you then see them as opportunities for filling in future books? Might Mort come back to us?
Oh, possibly. I hadn't.
I don't mean him specifically, but
right. I hadn't thought specifically of that. I'm trying now to think if in stuff I've written, if I've done that. I don't offhand think, but that's possible. It's in fact kind of a neat idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Your books use dialogue to great effect in telling these stories. I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
Oh, dialogue is very, very important to me. I think that speech is action, in a way, on the page. And while it's, it becomes boring, for me at least, to read made-up histories of people, and even to read bare accounts of their physical activities, to set them talking is always interesting,
mm-hmm,
and to distinguish different speakers by their quirks of speech, and to reveal them by not only the content of what they say, but the way they say it is always important to me. So yeah, the dialogue is more and more important. The more I write stuff like this, the more important it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, it's an interesting thing to me to reflect on that, because so many writers have apparently gone the same route. Many writers today, I think in particular the splendid writer, one of my great favorites is George V. Higgins, who died a few years ago and wrote about police and evildoers down in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote the marvelous novel The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Great book. And he got to the point where he was writing books that were virtually nothing but dialogue. That I wouldn't want to do, but he had the same kind of progression.
And maybe to him it was more about the fun of doing that than it was about appealing to a huge audience.
Maybe, and it is wonderful fun. I think so too.
Yeah,
it's great fun to write talk.
And I think that your dialogue is it's successful on a level that's difficult for writers sometimes, in that it's not. There's a sort of ping-pong effect mm-hmm. that's going on. People are not always answering each other's questions.
No. In fact, in the book that preceded this, Go With Me, it gets quite complicated because there's sometimes four or five people talking in the same circle, so to speak, and they're bouncing off multiple angles. It's like a billiard game.
Mm-hmm.
It gets quite complicated and quite difficult to keep it all straight. Fortunately, if it's all that complicated, probably the reader won't know if you screwed up.
Do you read your work aloud? I'm curious.
As I'm writing it?
Yeah.
No.
No.
I read it sort of, I read it in my head a lot, and I kind of hear it, but I don't literally read aloud to myself.
Okay. No. Sheriff Wing's wife, Clemmie, in All That I Have, she has more than a bit part, although she's not in every single chapter by any means, but her parts almost felt like she was achieving something of the devil's advocate to show the other side to certain things that Sheriff Wing was saying. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think she's a complicated character herself, and she comes from in some ways a different background from the sheriff's. And yeah, she does kind of hold the mirror up to him on one side, and for better and for worse, I think.
Mm-hmm. And her father is an interesting character. Sheriff Wing's father-in-law, one thing that I sort of enjoyed was the fact that Lucian doesn't like him. He says so at the beginning of the book, but he has a grudging respect for him, and
yes.
There's a complexity there in
yes.
the way that he interacts with him, which is...
Yes, and he turns out to be not such a bad guy at the end, I think. And they seem to... They seem to have made some sort of rapprochement at the end, the
yeah.
sheriff and his father-in-law.
Yeah. Do you write one thing at a time, or do you work on multiple projects at the same time?
For preference, I write one thing at a time. But I have, like I say, I write a whole lot of different kinds of things, and some of them I have commitments to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I sometimes have to kind of double up, and it's not a problem, but I would rather get done with something and then start something else.
Now, you no longer do the freelance technical type of writing, do you?
No, I haven't done that for decades.
Okay.
I worked as a freelance editor for years and years. I still do a little bit, but the technical, scientific stuff is long in the past.
Mm-hmm. And you write essays?
Yeah, I write essays for... I've written for 30 years or so. I have written a regular essay for the Old Farmer's Almanac.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
And now I'm writing a regular thing in Vermont Life, beginning... this year.
Okay.
And I've written for essays for lots of other magazines over the years. They're always about Vermont and the outdoors and history and that sort of thing. They're all kind of in the same field as the fiction that I write,
uh-huh.
but different kinds of things.
I love the Farmer's Almanac.
No.
I wish they would put that in waiting rooms and places where you have to be. And it's not the book that you pick up all the time, but when you do, you can spend hours looking
at
it.
Yeah, the Farmer's Almanac is great. There's much more to the Farmer's Almanac than the Old Farmer's Almanac than meets the eye.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun to write for them. They're great people.
Yeah, it sure is. What are you working on now?
I'm working on short things, on essays and short stories. I don't currently have another novel in the works. I expect to write more novels, but I'm not at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a couple of new stories and a couple of new essays that I'm working on, and So at the moment, that's what I'm doing.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach revision?
I write pretty slowly, and I get started, and I try to make pretty good as I go along. So when I've finished, going through writing, say, a story or an essay or a chapter of one of these books, it's not just sketched out exactly. So the process of revision is necessary, but I'm not really rewriting the whole thing. Not as a rule, not anyway. So I'm more apt to add things as I revise than I am to take things out.
I was going
to
ask that, because these novels, anyway, are fairly concise.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
they run
concise.
About 160, 170 pages.
They're very short.
So have you tossed a lot in order to get them so concise?
No, not much. These are not 400-page novels that got boiled down to 175.
Right.
When finished, when they're as finished draft, they're pretty much the size they are now.
Okay. And then you'll work on them a little more?
I work on stuff like the talk, like we were talking earlier about the dialogue and the speech of the character. I work a lot on that.
Right.
And the little digressive stories, I work a lot on those. I add them, actually. So it's more there's more apt to be, say, a 10% growth of size than a large reduction.
I want to just mention that you had a reviewer recently, the writer Charles Bach, in a recent NPR review of your previous book, Go With Me, said this: Freeman not only unpacks the social dynamics of Vermont's picturesque towns, he also takes readers into all the places they don't stop during a fall weekend road trip, that dilapidated bar by the side of the road, the wildcat logging camp, the abandoned school bus that serves as its bunkhouses, the woods of dark myths and bad men, and the unspeakable brutalities that take place in the blackest night. First of all, a wonderful review, very exciting review. But also, we did talk a little bit about how you show Vermont's changing aspect, but I'm curious, too, about these places that you're writing about. Are you going out and looking for research? You know, do you walk out in the woods? And
yeah, I do, and I walk out in the woods a lot. In Go With Me, an important part of the book is set in a kind of a semi-wilderness area. Mm-hmm. And that area, unlike the low bars and the sort of vaguely brothel-like motel and stuff, is a real place and corresponds to the Green Mountain National Forest at the southern end of the state, which is quite near where I live. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I spent a lot of time up there, just sort of walking around and wool gathering. And that's the woods are really quite, that's a pretty straightforward and I hope accurate description of that countryside up there. I don't spend a lot of time in the other.
Do you go in dilapidated bars?
Not a lot. Well, you know, I have in my life, yes, but not. I don't frequent them as I do the woods up in the mountains there that I was writing about.
Right. I've already referred to Sheriff Wing's simple wisdom. I would love to just read one little excerpt, if I may. At one point, another character starts a sentence with the words, "Look, Sheriff," and Wing makes this aside in his narration. "Look this, look that, you're big lookers, these important fellows are. When you hear that look, be careful, go slow, because the fellow who's telling you to look don't want you to. He wants you to think he's an honest, plain-talking, straight shooter who, when he says look, is getting ready to level with you. He ain't, he never is. He says look, but he means don't look." That was really fun. His asides are great.
I had been noticing this book was written during the early days of the run-up to the election last year.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't help noticing how so many people, TV commentators and also political figures themselves, when they are starting to say something, they say, look, you know? And they do, the administration that got in, that they, those people often say the same thing. If you ask somebody, well, so when is the stock market going to turn around? He will say, look, this is going to take time. Something like that. That's what I was. That it's just a kind of a tick of speech that I was hearing all the time, and
right.
It's not an unfamiliar tick of speech, but I guess I kind of picked that up for that.
Yeah, it was a good observation, or it was a recognizable observation. Have you had to deal a lot with rejection as a writer?
Oh, sure. Oh, God, yes. I have, especially as a writer of short stories. I have hundreds of rejections, and also as a novelist. That's absolutely part of the deal.
Yeah. Do you keep the rejections?
Absolutely, I got them all.
It's like a badge of honor, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of it is. Except now it's tough because it's so much of it is electronic, and you know an electronic rejection doesn't quite have the same cachet as a nice little piece of paper like a 3x5 rejection slip that they all used to send out and still do.
Yeah.
But yes, that's a big part of the deal, of course.
Yeah. Where could somebody find your short stories recently if they were looking?
Well, let's see. I've had stories recently in all literary magazines. One is the Southwest Review, mm-hmm. which is a very good magazine published at Southern Methodist in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a number published in the Ontario Review, which no longer exists, unfortunately,
but was published
in Princeton. Michigan Quarterly Review from Ann Arbor. New England Review from Middlebury. Places like that.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So I've actually had a great deal of trouble in the last couple of years. And in spite of relative, to me, success of my novels, I've had a real tough time getting stories published in the last couple of years. Not
I wonder
quite sure
if
why.
Electronic submissions makes that harder because people can send stuff off so quickly, and so the editors are even more
swamped than
before.
It can't help. I don't really know.
Yeah. I wonder if you could mention a few writers who might have influenced you. You did mention George Higgins.
George V. Higgins, yes. He's a great favorite of mine. There's hundreds of writers that are great favorites of mine. I think, for me, really, and especially as a fiction writer, the big figures are Twain and Joyce and Faulkner. I read them over and over and over. I have all my life, and they're always new and always wonderful to me.
Mm-hmm.
So they're my heroes, I guess, as literary people.
Do you have certain qualities that you appreciate in each one of those that you would talk about for a second, or?
I don't know. I guess in Twain, his humor.
Sure.
We talked about that earlier, and in Faulkner, his way of writing about this tiny little isolated community, in his case in Mississippi, and making it seem to take on a kind of cosmic meaning at the same time that you know his intimate knowledge of it and his ambivalent feelings for it. The whole idea of making up a place and then devoting your entire life to making it live and making it complex and making it important is enormously attractive to me. And Faulkner is, I guess, the main example in modern American writing of someone who has done that, although, of course, others have too, like Thomas Hardy and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And for Joyce, just his enormous invention and originality. And again, his humor. So the, those three people for those things.
Yeah. When you say you read them over and over and over, do you think that you've pretty much covered their work and you're rereading at this point?
No, I'm rereading. Yeah.
You're rereading.
I haven't, except perhaps in the case of Joyce, I haven't read every single thing that Twain or Faulkner have written, but I've read and reread much the better part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's reading, rereading them.
What are you reading now?
Well, let's see. I read. I'm reading actually, and I'm reading Plato. No kidding. I
for
am,
the right? Humor.
although in the Plato stuff that I've been reading, which are the dialogues surrounding the death of Socrates, there is a kind of humor in there. It's not, you don't roll on the floor and laugh until your sides hurt, but it's there. And I was, as a college student, I was a major in philosophy, and I got turned on to Plato then, and I like him a lot, and I've read him for fun ever since, and that's what, I've been reading him now, and then let's see, I have a book about, I've always been interested in the Battle of Little Bighorn, and there's a new Little Bighorn book, so I got that, so I'll be reading that.
Is that fiction or nonfiction?
No, that's history.
History.
I read someplace that the Battle of the Little Bighorn was when the Indians massacred General Custer and his guys out in Montana. And apparently more words have been written and published about that battle than about any other battle in American history, including the huge battles of the Civil War, including the Revolutionary
Wow.
War, including even some of the battles in the World Wars, which is astonishing to me, especially because in this book it says that the Battle of the Little Bighorn lasted about 20 minutes.
Wow.
And yet there's this huge, vast literature. And it's true. If you go on Amazon and look it up, it's just, it's astonishing.
That's interesting.
Anyway, it's an interest of mine, so I've been reading that book.
And it gives you plenty to read.
Yeah, well, oh, much too much, yes. No, you can't read all that stuff.
Do you work with an agent?
Yeah.
And is it the same person that you worked with earlier in your career?
Yes, or? I've had only one agent. Her name is Christina Ward. She's in near Boston. She's moved. She's now in Lowell. And she's been my agent for years and years. And for all my novels, I don't use an agent much for stories because I know where I'm sending them, and there's not really enough money involved to make it worth an agent's while. Mm-hmm. Although Kit, my agent, sometimes submits stuff for me. Same goes for essays. She's more an agent for novels,
mm-hmm.
and she's done a marvelous job for me.
Mm-hmm. How did you find her?
She was an editor years ago at Little Brown, and she was the editor who acquired a book by a friend of mine, and let's see. So I knew of her for that reason, and then she quit Little Brown and set up as an agent sometime in the 80s, I guess. And I guess my friend, whose editor she had been, steered me to her when she started out in agenting.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a not quite a cold call situation. It was I knew about her.
And how long ago was that?
That was probably before 1990. It was sometime in the 80s,
yeah.
I imagine. I'm guessing about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. My last question is always the same for writers.
Mm-hmm.
What advice might you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Well, I think that really, in a situation like that, what's needed is to kind of reboot and restart yourself and rededicate yourself, which means in some way getting yourself in a frame of mind where you can kind of go back to Adam and Eve as a writer. One way that you might do this that I've found successful is pick a a sequence of events, a simple, very simple sequence of events, something that's happened to you or a story that you know about. It could be a fairy tale. It could be any simple narrative. Or it could be a description of something. Or it could be a dream. Or it could be a story about an animal. Anything that's very simple. And what you do is you sit down and you write that, but you go very slowly. You make yourself go very slowly. So you're kind of going one word at a time, one sentence at a time. Keep it down 2 to 3 pages. That's not long. And it should be a very simple, very, very unfancy story, the content should be very simple. Just make yourself go slow and write that out as though you had never written anything before, as though nobody had ever written anything before. You want to get yourself kind of back into biblical times as a writer, and set on one side all the stuff that you think you know about it and all the stuff that you've done previously, and just try to get a real fresh start just for that little space. Hmm. And that can sometimes kind of get a momentum going that you can then apply to other things.
Do you try to write it as prose, or are you making just sort of a bullet list of...
I'm talking, in my case, writing it as prose. You're trying to make it well written.
Okay.
So you take pains, and you go, as I say, you go very slowly, and you kind of feel your way, and you go sentence by sentence. It's not long, it's only a couple of pages, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't be longer, and but you do try to write it, make it a good piece of writing.
And it's important that it be a very simple story.
That's my thought, just because then you don't worry about whether it's an interesting story or an important story. It doesn't have to be any of those things. It's easier. You get the benefit more with a very simple story. Mm-hmm. I always found Grimm's fairy tales very interesting for just this kind of thing.
Huh.
Because there's zillions of versions of all of them, and some of them are very short and simple. And I've used them, not in recent years, but in the past, I've used them to do kind of this sort of thing.
Hmm. That's great.
It's an interesting thing, and it kind of gets you sensitized to just the very idea of a narrative or a story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to say they're all alike, but the long ones and the short ones have a lot in common. You don't need hundreds of characters, you know, it's just a very simple thing.
The process.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Castle, thank you so much for talking with me.
No,
I really
my pleasure.
Appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Castle Freeman Jr. Next week, please tune in again to hear an interview with environmental journalist and consultant Laurel Neamey, author of the book Animal Investigators, about the world's first wildlife forensics lab. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Castle Freeman Jr. When he's gotten stuck in the past, Castle has tried this exercise to restart or rededicate himself as a writer. Take a very simple story, such as a fairy tale, a sequence of events, a dream, or something that's happened to you, and write a narrative of it. Get yourself in a frame of mind where you can go back to your roots as a writer. Keep it to 2 or 3 pages and write very slowly, one word at a time, one sentence at a time. Write as though you've never written anything before, as though no one has ever written anything before. Set aside all that you think you know about the story itself and about writing. As Castle says, get a real fresh start, just for that little space. A copy of this writing prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com.
Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is up next at 3 o'clock with The World of Music. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.